Usually at the start of our retreat period, I usually get nicely fired up. It's a time when I start to let go of much more of my duties and things which I have to do. Get deeper into meditation, get into the heart of this thing we call Buddhism. And so I'm very happy this evening to give a talk by request on the subject of renunciation. And it's worth thinking about, worth contemplating. Why it is that in all traditions, not just Buddhist traditions, like the people who are said to achieve the goal, the wise ones, the enlightened ones, the deeply spiritual ones, the saints, always those who've given up so much, who live very simply, who don't have even money, have very few clothes and very few possessions, who are celibate, whether it's people from Mahatma Gandhi or to some of the great saints of our time, or people like Jesus and Francis in our Western tradition, or some of the great monks and nuns which I've known in the Thai tradition, or the Sri Lankan Burmese tradition of Buddhism, or even in Tibetan tradition. Why is it that if we see someone who's supposed to be a holy man or a holy woman, and they drive around in a Rolls-Royce or Mercedes, that we tend to think there's something wrong there? And there is something which is deep in all traditions, which understands that the goal of enlightenment will also include a sense of simplicity, a sense of non-attachment, a sense of wanting few things or having few things. So this evening I'm going to explain why that is the case and how this is achieved through the path of renunciation. Another word for renunciation is letting go, giving up things, abandoning things, simplifying. And it goes against our modern world, which is always to accumulate more and more. The way of renunciation is to give up more and more. And I want to emphasize that one way actually leads to being a prisoner of our possessions, and the other way leads to this beautiful freedom. It's a strange thing. But when you practice a path of renunciation, and of course as a monk I've renounced so much over the years, but one thing which I haven't renounced is the happiness and the freedom, the peace of the mind, which comes from giving up. The whole life of being a Buddhist was always a path of stage by stage, little by little, when I felt comfortable about it, letting go of things. Whether it was renouncing some of the immoral ways which I used to live in my early life, in my early years. I think I've mentioned here before that when I was young, as a student, you used to go and get drunk with your friends, sometimes terribly drunk. Sometimes you used to go on the buses, you'd learned how to go on a bus without paying the full fare. And each of those little things you did because you thought you were going to get away with things. You thought how clever you were, how smart you were. But after a while, that possibly because I'd learned meditation when I was at uni, and when I started meditating, you get a sense of seeing things with clarity instead of just following what other people do. Just talking earlier today with someone that so many of our responses, attitudes, a way of looking at things in life, have all just come from conditioning. We've been brainwashed to see things and act in a certain way. We're specifically talking about the response to disappointments, tragedies, getting cancer, dying, those sorts of things which happen in life. Which our response is, if you hear that someone has got a cancer, say, oh, poor thing. Or someone's died, oh, that's sad. Why is it sad? Why is that a bad thing? It can be one of the greatest blessings for people in life. The point is that we have a certain social conditioning that if we press the right trigger, we get the same response. When I was young, it was going to a pub was one of the best things you could do of a Friday evening. Fortunately, you don't believe in that because you've come here instead. And I'm very, very glad to see that. And going to get drunk, used to say afterwards, what a great night that was. Yeah, what a great night that was. We all got drunk. But then I started to challenge sort of the received wisdom of my society. I started to ask questions. And one of the wonderful things about the Buddhist path is ask questions. Ask questions of the monks, but more so, ask questions of yourself. Don't have any dogmas inside your own mind. Like the idea that death is bad is a dogma. The idea of getting cancer is so sad is a dogma. In other words, it's a belief which we've just taken on board without examining it fully. Here we want to really challenge those things. Can we see it in a different way? And perhaps it was because of my little bit of meditation, you started to see things in a completely different way. Like taking alcohol. When I gave up alcohol, when I renounced alcohol, it was such an obvious thing to do. Every time you went to get drunk, afterwards you didn't know whether it was a good time or not. You're just trusting your friends to say it was a good time because you couldn't remember much about it. And they said it was a good time, and frankly, they didn't really remember much about it either. It was just assumed to be a good time. When you go and have a party, is it a good time? Why do you have to do all those things? You have to dress up, have to go and speak stupid things to stupid people, listen to loud music. Do we really enjoy it? But we think we've got to enjoy it. This is one of our problems. I was searching through my filing cabinet, my file in the filing cabinet in the monastery, just tidying things up for the retreat, and I came across a letter which I'd written to Amnesty International a few years ago. It was the anniversary of the 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And they invited me as the Buddhist representative to come to a fundraising dinner for Amnesty. And I had to write them a letter back saying that as a monk, I'm not allowed to eat at that time of the day in the evening. Nor am I allowed to take alcohol. I won't be able to enjoy the wine. You can just imagine what it'd be like for me as a monk, sitting there with an empty plate while the people around me I've got this wonderful food. Seeing you have this probably wonderful wine, and all I can have is orange juice. And I told them in the letter, that's a type of torture which Amnesty International should never condone. Why is it when people celebrate and have a dinner, they have to eat a lot and they have to drink alcohol? It's accepted in our society that is having fun, isn't it? If you have a celebration, what do? Do you have a glass of orange juice or a glass of champagne? Do you toast some person's health with a cup of Earl Grey? Why is it? This is our tradition. And as a monk, even no, not as a monk, even as a young man, I was challenging those traditions. And I continue to challenge those traditions. Is it really fun? Is it really good? Is it really what we're here for? And actually, that was very easy to renounce alcohol. One, because I couldn't afford it anyway. I was a student, and it used to cost a lot of money. It was bad for my health, and I didn't know what I was doing. Got into all sorts of trouble as a result, and it felt much better. And I tell people this because I thought it was a sacrifice whenever you renounce something. You give up something, people think you're a wowzer, you're not going to have a good time. Now, many of you have known me for many years. Now, am I a happy monk? I've given up sex, alcohol, music. Great fun doing that. Look at me. The point was that I thought at first it was a gamble. Giving up alcohol, renouncing that, I thought I'd never get invited to any parties. Who would want sort of a wowser at the party? Someone who doesn't drink like everyone else. But to my astonishment, and delight at the time, I got invited to even more parties because they wanted somebody sober to drive them home. There's always hidden benefits in these things. But more than that, I never lost anything. I gained so much by renouncing alcohol. Well, I could really enjoy the parties. I remembered all about it the following day, and I was fresh. I didn't have these terrible hangovers. I didn't lose all my money. I didn't do stupid things. You were enjoying yourself with a sense of control, the sense of being there at the time. You can enjoy yourself as much as anyone else, I would say even more. But more than that, whenever I renounced something and went against the stream what everyone else was doing, I felt inner strength. It's amazing. Every time I made those decisions, I felt inwardly strong. Well, I'd actually done something which was hard to do. I'd gone against the usual way of doing things. I wasn't just following other people like a sheep. I was making my own decisions, making my own way, rationally, with a heart, rather than just out of stupidity or out of fear. The Buddha actually taught that if you're going to make any decision in life, any choice for what you're going to do or what you're doing now, never act out of the four wrong motives. Those four wrong motives are acting out of desire, ill will, stupidity, or fear, or agati in Pali. And so often in life, I saw myself doing that, acting out of desire, wanting something, wanting to get something out of you, or wanting to get something out of the situation, or out of ill will because I just hate something or hate the situation, or a lot of times out of stupidity. But most of all, I found myself, and I think many people in the world act out of the fourth wrong motive, fear. You're not courageous enough to make your own decision because you're afraid what other people will think about you. You're not rational, you just follow the line out of fear of the consequences. To be a Buddhist, you have to develop a great sense of fearlessness. Walk your path, not somebody else's. Make your decisions. You will never get excommunicated from the Buddhist Society of Western Australia for making your own decisions. In fact, that's the path which leads to Nibbana. You'll see for yourself the truth which all men and women have seen over the centuries. And I saw that just giving something up, just the fact of stopping doing something, was actually a sense of strength. I could do this. I had a lot of Christian friends at college. One of my Christian friends, I lost contact with him. It was a great shame because we used to have some great arguments about religion, but good ones, really debate, pushing each other into a deeper understanding of our beliefs. But he went on a fast, so I went on a fast as well. And I challenged him so he could fast the longest. It's only 3 days, but for a young man without. And I really forced myself. In those days, you just have a bicycle. I would deliberately bicycle every evening past the fish and chip shop just to test my will. And I put a muffin on the mantelpiece of my room so I could see it. I didn't even actually sort of hide the food. I deliberately sought out the smells and the sights of food just to test my willpower. And I made it. He failed. I beat him to the 3 day fast. And it wasn't a fact of like beating my friend. What really impressed me inside was that I could do this. I could say no to even the desire to eat for 3 days. Eventually, I became a vegetarian at college. And even I got teased by my friends. They used to come up to me and look at my plate. They had all their meat on their plate. They said, "Call that rabbit food." And I asked them, what are rabbits famous for? Was at school, I was at college. Wasn't a monk then. But you had to sort of stand up for yourself, because I think it was, in the college there was only two vegetarians, and me and another sort of weirdo. That was a long time ago when it wasn't. Even the main vegetarian restaurant in London was called Crank's. That's its name. And that's a true story. I think it's still there, Crank's Restaurant. So that's actually. But when I did that, I decided I was going to be a vegetarian when all my friends and all my mates and the college had to cook special food for you. When I decided to do that, inside I felt strong. I felt like power inside. I'd gone against the stream. It was like flexing the muscles of my mind. You know, when you exercise at a gym, you can't push up light weights. To get strong, you have to stretch yourself, push against hard weights. And the harder the weight, the stronger you become. In the same way, the harder the decision was, the more I had to renounce, the tougher it was, the less other people were doing it, the stronger I felt inside. It was also a sense of self-esteem, inner strength, what you might call integrity. This was my beliefs. I wasn't going to push them down the throats of any of my friends. They could go and get drunk. I was to look after them afterwards. I wasn't going to criticize their lifestyle. I would sit down and have my vegetarian food next to all these carnivores sitting next to me. Used to tease them as much as they tease me. But it didn't really matter that I was doing what I thought was correct and right for me at that time. And I wasn't sort of following other people. And I didn't care what other people thought of me. There was a sense of like inner strength. I wasn't going with the four wrong motives. It wasn't done out of desire to get something. It wasn't stupidity. It wasn't ill will. I didn't sort of become a vegetarian because I hated meat. I didn't become a was it non-alcohol, not drinking alcohol because I hated alcohol. I did it because I thought it was a wise idea. And you did sense you had more freedom in your life. More energy, more time, more freedom, and also more money as a student. And this gave me like an insight, an understanding into the path of renunciation. In the second factor of the Eightfold Path, the Eightfold Path in Buddhism is a path to enlightenment. How to become enlightened. Second factor is three right thoughts, or motives, intentions. The first of those is the intention, the thoughts, the mind state of renunciation. Nekamma Sankappa in Pali. This is actually part of the Eightfold Path, part of becoming enlightened. Didn't realize such things at the time. You were going in a path which led to amazing things. We always think that we're going to get happiness not by renouncing things, but by amassing things. Not by giving up your choice of foods, but be able to eat whatever you like, whenever you want. Be able to drink whatever you want. Alcohol, be able to take whatever substances, drugs, whatever else. Be able to go wherever you want, whenever you want to do it. In fact, that's enshrined in Western culture in such things as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But really, I gave a talk about this a couple of years ago. That Universal Declaration of Human Rights, if you look at it deeply, it comes very much from a Western paradigm. And that's a lot of the reason why many Asian countries sort of balk about it. They say it's not real freedom after all. It's designed, made by Westerners. Or by Asians who have had Western education. Because in my own experience, and I ask this of you, with all of your so-called liberty to own, to possess, to go wherever you like, to enjoy relationships, do you really feel more freedom? The point is, in Buddhism, real freedom is not the freedom to follow your desires, which is what human rights is all about. Well, not all human rights, but part of it. The real freedom is the freedom from desires. It's a different paradigm. It's the ability to live life content rather than to have all of your desires stimulated, encouraged, buy, possess, go here, do this, experience that. Do you really feel freedom that way? How much have you got? Is that really giving you what you expected from all those possessions, all those relationships, all those experiences? So every time I gave up something, I was actually freeing myself from the tyranny of those desires of having to have nice food, having to have alcohol, having to have this, have that. And so it became a natural progression for me to try out being a monk, giving up sex. Not only giving up that, but giving up much of my ability to move around and do what I wanted in life. I'd like to mention that myself and many other monks, we weren't losers in life. This wasn't just a last resort. You don't succeed in life, you can become a monk. I didn't become a monk because of some relationship which went terribly, terribly wrong, and I became a monk to forget. But then again, I might have done because I've forgotten. I'm really impressed that many of my fellow monks and nuns, if they would have stayed in the world, they'd have been very successful. You know, there's some of the monks have got very, very wealthy parents. You know, the tallest building in the world, the Twin Towers in Kuala Lumpur. The person who built that, I think he owns one of them. I think the government owns the other tower. His son is a monk in our monastery in Thailand. His father goes to visit him every now and again in his private plane. One of our monks, his father was Canadian million multi-millionaire, and offered him $1 million US, no questions asked, if he would disrobe. No. Another monk I knew, his father owned his big insurance company in South Africa. Another monk was a Rhodes Scholar. Another monk, he was used to be an actor in the National Theatre. He was a friend of Tony Hopkins under Laurence Olivier. Told me all his stories about Larry. That's Laurence Olivier. So monks were not losers. The nuns aren't losers. In fact, if you look at the monks and nuns, especially in the Western Sangha, you'll be amazed just at the quality of their achievements before they became a monk, let alone afterwards. Why did such people, with the world at their feet, renounce all of that to become a monk and just eat whatever falls in your bowl, just to have just one or two robes, to sleep on the floor, no sex, no movies, no radio, no TV? When I renounced and became a monk, it's a marvelous feeling of freedom. It was wonderful being able to relate to women as a monk with no sexuality involved at all. And it's wonderful even now as a monk for many, many years. You talk to a lady and they're not an object of desire. They're a human being. And I can look upon any woman, any man with the same view, the same eyes. That sexuality, which stops a lot of conversation stops a lot of understanding and meaning between different genders. It's taken away. You can really relate to people. They can trust you, and you can trust them. It was one of the complications of communicating with each other has been taken away. And as a monk who doesn't own any money, when anyone comes and talks to me, they don't think, what's he getting out of this? Does he want a donation after this? Is he going to charge me for if I give him advice? It's marvelous when you don't have anything to do with money that that's taken away as well. So there's a lot of barriers between communication gets taken away when you renounce these things. I've got nothing to gain from anyone. Even if you come and tell me all your secrets, because of my precepts, I can't even blackmail you. It'd be a wonderful way to raise money for the Buddhist society. I got all these secrets which people tell me. I'll never tell anybody. And so, whenever you renounce these things, barriers get taken away. Not only that, but with that renunciation, you do actually get a feeling of inner freedom. It took a long while to figure out what's going on. Why is it that when you let go of things, you seem to be more free, more happy, even more wealthy? I've asked this question before. Can you remember the answer? Who's the wealthiest person in Australia? Who's the wealthiest person in Australia? Wealthiest people in Australia? Monks and nuns. In Buddhism, the Buddha actually said this: the highest wealth is contentment. Think about it. The highest wealth is contentment. Isn't that worth much more than $1 million, $10 million, $100 million? How many $1 million do you want anyway? Ask yourself that. If you had $1 million, would that be enough? $1 billion, would that be enough? Say yes, but for how long? $10 billion, $100 billion. Why is it that people who have $100 billion have to work every day, 7 days a week? Does Bill Gates ever get time off? No. The more you have, the more you are in a prison, the less freedom you have. I've known millionaires. They haven't got a fraction of the freedom of a monk or a nun. They haven't even got a fraction of your freedom. So whenever you do renounce, you find you do actually get more of freedom. And figuring this out, I sometimes use a simile of a balloon, hot air balloon. In a hot air balloon, to go higher, what do you have to do? Throw something out. Throw something out and you go higher. Throw something more out, you go higher still. Throw something more out. There's always something you can throw out of that hot air balloon. And that's what I've been practicing all my life, throwing things out. I'm a great thrower outer. I threw out sort of alcohol, I threw out lying, I threw out sort of money. I gave away all my money before I was a monk. That was a marvelous thing to do. This is one of my. I had a motorbike. This was before I was a monk. I had to get rid of it because I couldn't take a motorbike to Thailand, and you can't ride motorbikes as a monk. So I talked to a few of my friends, but they weren't interested in it. It was actually a friend of my mother's was interested in that motorbike. And so he came round to see it. I showed it to him. He was interested in it. He said, "Yeah, I like it." And he said, "Let's go upstairs. We'll settle up. Fix a price." So in front of my mother, thank goodness she was there, because otherwise it would all gone wrong. He said, "How much do you want for it?" And I said, "Do you really want it?" He said, "Yeah, how much?" And with great delight, I said, "If you really want it, you can have it for free. No money." I always remember that look on his face. That was worth hundreds and hundreds of pounds to see that look on his face. He turned around to my mother with that same look. She understood. And she said, "Don't worry, he's all right. He's going to become a monk." He thought I was crazy. My mother told me afterwards that was the first time in that man's life he'd been given something for free like that. It moved him. It's marvelous when you can do things like that. Just give from your heart. I didn't need the money. What would I do with money as a monk? And so he got that bike, and I got so much happiness as a result. And it's marvelous giving up money as a monk. What do you need money for anyway? That's why, we renounce these things. That's why we've got those donation boxes at the end there, so you can renounce your money before you leave. No, we're doing fine. We don't need that. We do very well on blackmail. But when you start giving away things, you get really into this. And as a monk, not only were you celibate, but you also had few possessions. And it's amazing just how little you can get by on. That part of our training as monks and nuns is to have as little as possible. And I think when we had our entry to the rains day at our monastery at Serpentine the other day, one of the monks who took you on tours, some of the people on tours of the monks' huts, I was very pleased when he came back and said he went into two monks' huts in our monastery. And he and all the other visitors were very impressed. There was hardly anything there in the hut. It was empty, no furniture, sleeping on the floor. No knick-knacks, just a couple of robes and a book. That's all. These monks I've got in my monastery, I'm very proud of them. And they live so happily with few things. They don't need anything. Part of my training, after 5 years, we had to leave the monastery and just go walking in Thailand. We had to walk, taking all our possessions with us. It was hot in Thailand. And if you carry too much, you'd soon get very sweaty. And it was amazing. I started off taking too much. It was a big bag, the JIC bag, just in case. That soon disappeared. And after a week, I was traveling so lightly, just a bowl and a couple of robes. That's all you needed. And you had this wonderful feeling. I had no possessions left in the monastery. You weren't allowed to store anything. All that I owned in the world, I was carrying with me. And that tremendous feeling of freedom and space and emptiness. And I could go in whatever direction I wanted. At every crossroads in that country of Thailand, I could go east, west, north, or south. And I had nobody behind me, nobody in front of me, no possessions holding me back, no desires pulling me forward. Incredible sense of freedom of the mind, being a wandering mendicant monk. In Europe, they used to have that tradition of wandering monks. They too would just go with whatever they had. Nothing. There was a complete antithesis of our modern world when we don't even live in houses anymore, we live in mansions. When we each have our own car, sometimes three cars to a house, sometimes a TV in each room, even in the loo as well. I saw in a newspaper, you probably saw it as well. You can have these shower caps, which you can actually sing karaoke to in the shower. Crazy. But it's not just for the sake of simplicity outside, because that renunciation, that simplicity outside, gives you so much more time. When you've got few things, you've got few burdens in life. How much time is spent with accumulating, maintaining, and cleaning your possessions? How much time do you spend on those things? Somebody came to our monastery some years ago. They were from the, I think, the Jarrowdale Women's Institute. They wanted an afternoon out, and we were one of the local sites to see, a nice weird way of spending the afternoon, go and visit the monks. So they came down, and no, they were really great fun. I really enjoyed their company. But one of the nicest things was we took them. I took them to one of the huts. And this sort of middle-aged, Aussie lady. And she looked inside and said, "Wow, that was my house. I could get all my housework done in half an hour." That was her comment. How hard it is to clean up your house. That's why we eat out of one bowl. Only one thing to wash up. You should do that with your husband. Just give him one bowl. Put everything in there. Give him one meal a day. So, because you don't like washing up. That simplicity gives an incredible amount of freedom. That's why we have our raids retreat now. And we've still got to maintain our monastery. We've got this roster so we can sweep, clean. And I think it's only, I think monks do it 2 weeks out of the whole 3 months, and it's only about maybe an hour every other day or something. Hardly any work at all to maintain that monastery where we live in Serpentine. We keep it very clean. Low maintenance, because there's few things there. Now that is a reflection on how to develop meditation as well. When you've got few things, you've got few things to worry about in your mind. Just like that monk's room. Hardly anything in there. Doesn't take hardly anything to keep it clean. Your mind, your room in which you live inside. When it's got lots of things in there, it's very hard to keep clean. What possessions have you got in your mind? All the things which you hold on to inside. Those are our spiritual possessions. Not the material possessions, but the spiritual possessions. They're the ones we really need to renounce. That's why when you get into renouncing outside there in the world, you can renounce inside as well. The two very basically go together. That's why a really holy person, if they've got lots of material possessions, it just shows they're basically stupid. What do they need all that stuff for? They haven't understood that contentment is the highest wealth. Being content with few things. What do you need? Why keep all these things just in case for the future? It's convenient but troublesome. So by giving things away, letting things go, renouncing, you learn the way of renouncing in the mind. Why is it that we can't renounce the past? All these terrible things which happened to you in the past, lost a son, lost a daughter, had an argument, had a terrible divorce, had this rotten experience, were abused, whatever. You know that only tortures us because we refuse to let it go. We refuse to renounce it. Who is forcing you? Who is making you keep on to those, keep holding those memories, keep holding those ideas? You've heard me say before, if someone calls you a stupid fool, and you start thinking, why do they keep calling me a stupid fool? I'm not a stupid fool. If anyone's a stupid fool, they are. And already you've called yourself a stupid fool 3 more times. Every time you remember it hurts. Isn't it wonderful if they call you a stupid fool? It's gone. Past. Always in the present moment. and call you an idiot until the cows come home. You don't hold anything. Don't hold the praise from the past, nor do you hold the blame from the past. You don't hold the bad experiences, nor the good experiences. Then you are free of the past. We call it forgiveness, but that's just another word for letting go, renouncing. Renounce your past. Then you don't have to burden yourself with it. You know, a lot of us are imprisoned by the past. We've got a jail sentence, and the door of that jail is open right now. We can walk out at any time, but we just refuse to walk out. We like jail. We want to suffer. And we need to let go of the past. It's gone. Why do we keep thinking about it? Habit. Conditioning. The same way that I rebelled against the conditioning that having a party with alcohol is good fun. I rebelled against the conditioning that when your father dies, you're supposed to cry. I rebelled against the conditioning that if you don't have sex, you're really weird. I rebelled against all of that. I rebelled against the tradition that you've got to feel guilty if you've done something wrong. Why? Why should, who's telling you should feel guilty if you've done something wrong? What does that guilt do? What does that grief do? Which is another type of guilt, holding on to the past. What does that do to you? What it does to you, it just makes you so painful inside. You cannot really be kind, compassionate, and effective in the present. You cannot be a full human being if you're still grieving about the past, or if you're guilty, grieving about your own mistakes in the past, holding those on, holding on to those. We have to let go. We have to forgive. We have to wash ourselves. And so we're not dirtied and soiled by the grime and stuff of the past. The Buddha was marvelous. He said, why not do that? You've got somebody in Buddhist tradition. There's examples. These are not just theory. There was a serial killer in the time of the Buddha called Angulimala. One of the words which many traditional Buddhists, they know that story often, many times. They've seen it even acted out in the Dharma school. Angulimala, serial killer. He met the Buddha, and the Buddha didn't say you should feel guilty, do a penance. He said, stop. That's what he said. Stop. Your grief, stop. Your guilt, stop. Stop it. That man did stop. When he stopped, he was free enough to become a monk. And very shortly became an enlightened monk, one of the great arahats, great saints in Buddhism. Another lady, Patachara, lost her husband, two children, and parents on the very same day. She went crazy, out of her mind. In modern jargon, she would be need therapy for years and years and years. She became a bhikkhuni, a great nun, not only an arahat, fully enlightened, but one of the great teachers of that time. She was a marvelous woman. All of that pain of the past, how can you get rid of that? Are you supposed to feel grief? And some of that was actually her fault, her two children dying. But she completely transcended that, let it go. She was free of that. She renounced the past, renounced the future. Why worry about what's going to happen next? It's one of the reasons why I can give a talk without worrying about what I'm going to talk about. Because I don't know what I'm going to talk about. I don't even think what I'm going to talk about. Let's keep on talking. Something will come out. We don't renounce the past, renounce the future. Why is it when you sit down to meditate, this past and the future keep coming up, even though you don't have to worry about it, because it's a habit. We don't say stop. We haven't learned how to renounce and give it up, throw it away. All the thoughts and ideas you have, your own philosophies of life, even your understanding of Buddhism. How about throwing that out as well, renouncing that, being silent for a change? Don't know Buddhism. I don't think Buddhism. Know Buddhism. The truth was always in silence. You never find the truth in words. All those ideas, those labels, all those books. Is that really truth? In Buddhism, we call that just the menu. That's not the food. But how many people, anything they ever eat is the menus. Go to one restaurant, chomp, chomp, chomp on the menu. Another one, have menu sandwiches, menu on toast. They never actually eat food, they only eat menus. In other words, what they're doing, they're only just thinking about truth, discussing it, labeling it, never actually knowing it, never tasting the food. So you get into this meditation, just let go of all of those words. You find you're actually experiencing life for a change. Instead of thinking about it, you can actually feel the pain in the body rather than having this great conversation of fear around it. You can actually know peace rather than wanting to write a book about it. As you renounce the inner speech, you find you're getting so much closer to truth and also freedom again. It's amazing in silence to know the freedom from all these words. It's these words which are your jailers. It's the words which make you angry at your husband. It's the words, you know, which make you get fed up with your wife. It's all the words which keep you grieving, keep you wanting. It's all words inside, in a conversation. So much of that, if you buy into and believe, will just make you crazy. In silence is a sense of truth and freedom. But when we talk about renouncing, we go even further. We want to renounce not just the thoughts. In Buddhism, we want to renounce this body as well. Know that... Just read recently, somebody sent something from the internet. A doctor in Southampton had done, again, some more research on out-of-the-body experiences. In his hospital, many patients who died on the operating table, he too gave them a questionnaire. He too found the same results. He presented this paper recently at Caltech. I think it's supposed to be the university in California with the highest number of Nobel Prize winners. He had the guts to say that consciousness survives death. He said it's what the evidence shows. Not every person who died on the operating table had these experiences, but a number, 60 or 100 people had those experiences. You could check them out, that they could actually see what was going on. They could hear because those words were spoken, but they were dead at the time. He was actually showing... So that the mind, consciousness, exists outside of the body. And this body of ours, that's something also which in Buddhism we renounce. You're going to have to get rid of it sooner or later, when you die. They say you can't take it with you. You can't take your money with you. You can't take your possessions with you. You can't take your body with you either. So what we do take with us is this continuation, this process, this stream of consciousness, which we call mind. It'd be wonderful to get to know that mind before you die, so you can actually get some practice in. Meditation, people call it practicing how to die. And it's not a bad description. So, you have to sort of, even these days, you have to practice before you play tennis. You have to practice before you drive a car. Got to get a license first of all. Even these days, you have to practice before you get married. You go to, so you do have these marriage classes. How about having some practice how to die? You might not get married, you might not drive a car, you might not play tennis, but you all are going to die. So you might as well get some practice in while the going's good. And what is dying anyway but letting go of this body? Renunciation is the opposite of attachment. And unfortunately, I've seen this. I've been with people when they're dying. And some of them, unfortunately, are so attached to their body and other people's body, they don't know how to let go. The time of their death comes and it's unpleasant for them. They struggle to hang on. Some of you may have unfortunately seen some close relations and friends have been like that, struggling to hold on when nature is telling them to let go. Why do we do that? It's absolute stupidity. We're going to die anyway. You can't fight these things when it happens, so just let go and enjoy the ride. Why not enjoy the ride as well? Death, if you know how to do it, is a very pleasant experience. It's an ending of suffering. People who die are usually in pain, weak, sick. Healthy people don't die. Sick people, ill people. Or if you get in an accident, your body's mangled before you die. It's all pain. And death is a great release. All people who remember that experience always remember that leaving their body is just so peaceful, so wonderful, one of the most delightful experiences they've ever had. In the same way, when you leave your body in meditation, I don't mean floating outside, I'm going deep inside until you're beyond your body. You feel this tremendous happiness and peace inside. In meditation, this part of meditation, you actually leave your body behind. Not go out into space, but go deep inside the mind. That is always bliss. We call that the jhanas. I mention this because the Buddha said that even the first jhana, when the body is completely gone, you can't hear, you can't see, you can't feel anything in the body, everything's just disappeared, and you're just left with bliss. That bliss the Buddha called, one of the things he called it Nekamasukha, the bliss of renunciation. This is the paycheck, the payoff of giving up things. Now, any person, monk, nun, layman, laywoman, who's even come close to that bliss of renunciation, you've actually got into it, you know that that in your life is the most wonderful experience, both in the sheer pleasure and in the profundity of it. You realize that by giving up things, you get this enormous pleasure, this enormous freedom, this enormous sense of stillness and contentment. Then you're realizing from your own experience, raw experience, what the Buddha meant by wealth. No money can buy those sorts of pleasures. No money can buy that type of freedom and that type of security. You've freed yourself from this body. You realize just how heavy a burden this body is. I'm not talking this as theory. This is raw experience. You realize this is why people renounce, why they let go. For fun. For the sheer happiness of it. In the same way that I let go of alcohol, the sheer happiness of it. I was much happier without it than with it. Same way you let go of the body, the sheer happiness of it. But also because it gives you huge insights, understandings into the nature of what this mind truly is. What death is? What you are? You know you're not the body. This is not the only body you've had. You've had many bodies before. Old ones, young ones. You've been men and women, and animals as well. Many bodies, many lives. You're not the body. So why are we just so concerned with this one? When it gets old, throw it away and get a new model. Actually, I don't even encourage that because you just can't get a new model. You have to sort of grow this model again from scratch. I said last time, going back to school again, going into nappies, being told off by your mum and dad, and all this sort of stuff again. Don't think that you've finished school. Imagine being a baby all over again. All those people who have retired who think you're finished with work. You get reborn again, there's many, many Monday mornings in front of you. Let go of this body. Know what the mind is. So in this renunciation, it's not just the bliss of renunciation, it's the wisdom of renunciation. When you let go of these things, it reveals what all of these coverings has hidden up, hidden. Nature of mind. And this is not something which I'm going to write another menu about. This is something which I want everyone to experience for themselves. So you know from your own experience what mind is. Anyone who's got into those deep meditations will have know two things. One, you'll know the body is not so important. Certainly, you get rid of the fear of death and the worry about other people's deaths as well. You know that death is not a big thing, it's not a be all and end all of life. But life goes on. Also, you know that this body, looking after it, look after it as best you can, but you know you can't sort of maintain this body. Your fear of death disappears. And also, understanding about laws of reincarnation, rebirth, is so obvious if you get into any of these states of mind. And just it becomes craziness. The biggest stupidity of our age is to think that we only live one life. Because we think we only live one life, all the stupid things which happens from that assumption is getting as much pleasure as you can. Imagine if everybody knew they were going to come back again. Wouldn't we take better care of our planet if we knew we'd have to come back again? Wouldn't we take better care of our old people to know that they're going to be our youth? This is a reason why we got problems with youth, because we didn't take good care of them when they were old people before. That's my theory. Now they're getting their own back. We just shove people in nursing homes and just don't look after them, maltreat them. They're going to take it out on us when they come back again. So looking after old people is an investment for the future. The marvelous thing is, we wouldn't be so concerned about just carrying on at all costs. Well, this is actually some of the wisdom aspect, but also the wisdom aspect that the mind is paramount. Not the body, not things, but the mind. The quality of your mind, the wealth of your mind is much more important than the wealth of your body or your house. Spiritual qualities become paramount. Compassion, wisdom, kindness. Those are the qualities, generosity, which become paramount once you realize that the mind is most important. So you measure a person not by how much money they have or how beautiful their face is. It's how beautiful their mind is, their heart is, how pure they are, how content they are, how happy they are inside. That's the measure of a person's wealth, and that becomes what we aspire to. We don't work hard to get worldly wealth. We work hard to get the spiritual wealth. We work in order to feed our body, but our main aim is to feed our mind. But when we renounce, this is what happens. This is a part of renunciation. It's a fun path to do. Throwing things out of your basket. Not only do you get higher and higher and higher, but the view gets better the higher you get. That's why often the Buddha called this the path of renunciation, the path of bliss. That's the talk for this evening. Any questions for this evening? No? Good. I'm pretty late today, so I went over. So you can ask questions afterwards. But our president, and if you didn't like the talk this evening, he's the one to blame because he's the one who suggested it. If you like the talk, please thank him.